Whatever meeting I start, someone else has to be the host. And I'm glad that it doesn't only happen to me. I feel better now, Sam.
Maybe I'm not like logged in correctly. And there's not even a like claim a host option. I guess because Ken just took over.
Meeting is not being recorded by me.
Perfect. Thanks, Ken. Did you record to the cloud?
No, I recorded to my laptop and I'll have to upload it.
Okay. That'll work. Thanks, Ken, for hitting the record button, since I'm apparently without the power to do so. Welcome to the Aries Working Group call for March 11th. And we have a pretty good batch of stuff that we're going to talk about here today. If you could add yourself to the attendee list, that would be helpful. Meeting link is in the chat. And please mind the Hyperledger Code of Conduct and the antitrust policy so that we can create a friendly working environment and avoid any legal problems with the output of our efforts. Welcome introductions. Is there anyone who'd like to introduce themselves that hasn't before? Okay, I think I recognize about everybody. Announcements. IW is April the 28th through the 30th. I have been told by conference organizers that it will happen in one form or another. I believe they are probably considering remote options, et cetera. The event is too important to not have happen in some form or another. So that's going on. April 28th through the 30th is there. And I suspect we will hear relatively soon about that. Related meetings. This is out of order here, but the DIF DIDCOM working group, we talked this week about the pattern of using initial values as a matrix parameter for DIDs and the mechanism of using that for both ephemeral connections and for passing peer DIDs along with the initial DID document that those require. So that was a good discussion. If that recording isn't posted in the doc yet, then I will add it shortly. But that was a good discussion as we look forward to what might be sort of the best thing going forward for DIDCOM in the long run. So that's that. Other meetings that ought to be reviewed. Okay. Work on project releases and work updates. Last week was kind of a busy week. A bunch of us were at the Hyperledger Global Forum. Any announcements from work projects? Aries Cloud Agent Python?
Yep, so 4.5 has been released. So those using it should grab that. There was a little bit of not much in it, just a little tweak to something that had been in there earlier that needed to be revised. The other thing is revocation has now been merged. It's not been released yet, so it'll be in the next release, but revocation is there. It is functional at this point. We're looking at various behaviors and adjusting things, and then we're also gonna figure out about Stephen Klump, about a year and a half ago, did a Tails file, a Tails server implementation, and so we're going to take a look at that as to how we can do that to host Tails files for the revocation. We did look at one of the things we'll have to do is limit the size of Tails files, so the number of credentials that can be in a single revocation registry. You can have multiple of those, so that doesn't hard limit how many credentials you can issue, but we definitely don't want to use these for very large implementations because the mobile phone, for example, just can't handle either the bandwidth or the size of the Tails files. So they've got to be in constrained use cases, but revocation should be available soon. We are starting to work as well with Street Cred initially on seeing whether their mobile agent handles it and what tweaks have to be made so that the mobile agent can do a proof of non-revocation as part of a proof. in theory, it's just passing it to Indy and it works, but we'll just have to figure out what pieces are needed.
Very cool to see that. This is probably a larger discussion we shouldn't have right now, but I was wondering if we could just, as a stopgap in the meantime, just allow configuration of an S3 bucket that could be used for hosting those. And that way it sort of generally.
I can do as well. I know Stephen was doing things like, you know, he didn't want it to be used as a arbitrary file holder for anyone who discovered it and wanted to use it. So he was doing something like each file is checked to make sure it's referenced in a revocation registry within Sovereign. So on the ledger that it's related to, something like that. So those types of checks were in there, but yeah, basically that's the same thing. We'll just host one out of our OpenShift environment here in BCGov, and people are welcome to use it.
Cool. Very awesome. Aries Framework Go.
Hey guys, nothing really new to announce. We're just working on the credentials and credential flows.
Very cool. Aries Toolbox, Daniel, would you like to talk about those recent things?
Sure. So over this past weekend, we did an Insta Sprint thing where we added payment support to the toolbox. This is intended to be used with a variety of payment methods, but we did an initial pass for Sovereign Test Tokens with the Akapai plugin for the toolbox. And that was just merged a little bit ago. So, and then we also have updates coming for the connection and invitation admin protocols soon-ish.
Very cool. Other work projects?
Yeah, Sam, this is Jack. Nothing immediate on the Ruby, except I did do a database Docker. I don't think I posted it up. I'll try to get it later and put it in the notes. But thank you. I want to take this opportunity to thank everybody at the Hyperledger Global Forum last week. I brought a contingent from the Government Blockchain Association. Everybody was very kind and patient, and thank you everyone for your time and the help and explanation. So appreciate it very much.
Awesome. Glad to hear that things went well. On the agenda a little bit later is a bit of a review of kind of what happened and stuff so that we can, those of us that weren't there can understand a little bit more. Other work projects before we get onto our agenda.
I have not looked at the prototype call test suite in a while. Would Daniel be willing to tell us about what's changed in the past 3 or 4 weeks?
The unfortunate answer to that is not much. So after getting the credential issuance and presentations implemented in the test suite, I personally have not had very much time to focus on that. So I don't believe there's been much, if any, developments there recently.
Thank you.
Yep.
Other work projects. Awesome. Very cool. Thanks everyone for all the work you do. We have enough of a stacked list of topics to talk about today that are likely to prompt discussion that I actually am intending to skip the issue game today. But I wanted to ask, is there any one specifically that anyone wanted to bring up in this meeting to talk about before we move along with the agenda?
There's no dunking booth. We need one.
We need one?
Yeah, that's a big issue here.
I will need to consult the no dunking policy advisement under the CDC, and then we'll get back to you. Perfect. Okay. I'd love to sort of open the floor to those who were at the Hyperledger Global Forum to talk about things they learned, experiences they had, what it was like, observations they had. It's useful when you get together and things like that to be able to discover things you might not have been aware of before, and would love to hear about the forum. So I wasn't going to assign anyone in particular, but I was hoping to hear from those who had gone to get some feedback from them.
The biggest thing I noticed was that although Indy and Aries were barely mentioned in the keynotes and in the, you know, the main presentations early in the mornings, the two sessions, two workshops, more than half the attendees that were there attended the two workshops on Indian Aries. I went to a Fabric 101 session that was sparsely attended and extraordinarily complicated. It was pretty interesting to see. So I think there's a huge interest. And when I say main presentations, I mean like main stage keynote stuff. Like Brian Bellendorf didn't talk about it at all, basically. You know, as they say, more than half the attendees of the workshop were at Indy Aries ones, the one that BCGov put on and the one that Sovereign put on. And there were lots of sessions on identity and Aries-based solutions during the rest of the conference. So that was interesting. We did talk to a lot of people and, Fabric, it's mostly discussions about, how do you manage a node? There was tons of companies offering free node hosting services and things like that. Aries, it was all about use cases and how do you use it for this and how do you use it for that, and a lot of excitement generated. So I think that was my main takeaway from it.
Sam, you're being too modest. It was standing room only in those sessions.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and as I say, there were four other sessions going on in parallel with those sessions on Thursday and Friday. And as I say, more than half were at the sessions were Indian Aries.
Yeah, and Stephen's being very modest. We almost got to the fire code limit on the room for the BCGov session. It was very well attended and it was very well worthwhile.
And it wasn't just those two sessions. We had one or two identity-related sessions every single hour the entire week. And they were all well attended, and people kept saying, we know we need blockchain, but we also need identity on blockchain.
And the Birds of a Feather session, Richard, you led some of those. While informally structured, they were very lively discussions. And again, I want to thank you and others. The four Government Blockchain Association people that showed up, they said they really got a lot out of attending the event. So thank you.
And I have to say that the most interesting session for me were the two sessions that the CTO of SecureKey hosted. So Troy, George, rest of that team. I really enjoyed hearing more about the SecureKey solution and about the plans to release a lot of that code, a lot of the Fabric Aries compatibility code in the future. He showed us the GitHub repository. We should expect to see it. That's really exciting to see because people are always asking, how do we integrate identity into Fabric? And I now have a pretty decent answer. Look at the team. Look at the work that you guys are open sourcing. It's really nice stuff. As other people come off mute, my other key finding, I was surprised how many people you talked about governance and the difficulty of deciding who's an issuer, and a lot of the trust over IP work that Drummond and John Jordan have been doing seems really relevant, especially during the Bird of a Feather sessions at lunch. Some of the talks between sessions, I'd ask people, what do they do with identity? And they say, oh, I'm helping people structure their credentials. I'm helping people decide what kind of credentials are important for this industry or that industry. So it's really nice. You'll say, well, there's this thing that's coming called Trust Over IP, and there's this set of standards called Aries that solve that problem. So very cool.
Thank you, everyone, for your comments and reporting on it. Anyone else would like to add any other comments about the Hyperledger Global Forum?
This is Ken. I was struck by the lack of overlap between the attendees between the VCGov presentation on Thursday and the Sovereign presentation on Friday. The attendees were mostly unique for each session.
Obviously, it was the other half.
I think so.
I was also really struck by the Evernim contributed libvcx a year and a half ago to the Indy SDK, and there was a lot of conversation in the Aries community about do we like the approach that was taken to keep provide a lot of shared libraries under a REST API, a lot of shared protocol adoption, things like that, and we decided to keep it more at the framework layer. But the ABSA team took libvcx, filled in the gaps that Evernim hadn't provided around the agency piece, and are using it actively. And so it reopened the conversation quite a bit about, you know, how do we keep shared libraries, how do we keep all the frameworks evolving together, and how do we keep shared libraries that provide some of the helper functions that libvcx does, how does that move into the Aries ecosystem? I expect that's going to be a conversation we're going to continue over the next 6 months.
Did I spell ABSA right, ABSA, or is that different?
That's correct, but I think it's, I don't think it's an acronym. I might be wrong. No, it is the something Bank of South Africa. So it is like that, yeah.
Another thing that I thought was interesting, this is Ken again, is that there, although we demoed StreetCred and ConnectMe in the Sovereign presentation showing those agents interacting with either an IoT device or an Akapai instance, there are now a total of 8 agents, mobile agents, that I'm now aware of that I think we should probably invite some of those other agents to come present at some point to the Aries community here so we get an idea of some of their other capabilities.
Mushmi, I apologize if I mispronounced that, has requested a recording of the session with SecureKey. Were any of these sessions recorded? Does anyone happen to know?
There's a YouTube playlist, the Hyperledger, the Hyperledger org on YouTube that has all the sessions. I haven't specifically checked for those two. When I checked this morning, half of the Evernim ones have been posted, but not all of them. So I can put a link into that.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure the workshops were not recorded, so I doubt they will be there.
Yeah.
Was the SecureKey one a workshop?
No, the SecureKey one was not.
Okay, perfect. That was the one she asked about specifically. So.
Sorry, it wasn't a workshop, but it wasn't a standard session because it was a smaller slot. I think there was a camera in the room. Anyway, I'm gonna have to check, but they did one on, there were two different ones. They did, the first day was about their use case and the second day was about their Aries contributions.
Cool. Hopefully we can find that.
It'll be helpful if you can post a link to the YouTube channel.
I'll put that in the agenda.
Thanks.
Thanks, Richard. Other comments? All these things are just general observations and things like that are incredibly useful as well for the rest of us.
Shaking hands is not a thing, and that's the last conference there's going to be for quite a while, I would guess.
Was it pretty actively obvious that people were not?
Yeah.
They said that they had lost about half their attendees because of as cancellations that they attributed to pandemic concerns. And people were pretty strict about elbow bumping or foot bumping, whatever we called it. It was interesting.
That's it's hard to see this. Looking forward to conferences. That, I mean, there's some ups and some downs. The upsides seem to be that a whole lot of people are trying remote work for the first time, and I'm sure some people will love it and some people will hate it. It's hard to replicate the in-person nature of events, but it kind of is what it is. So we'll see what happens as we look forward to other conferences and things, and we'll see how long this takes to continue on. Luckily, calls like this will be able to continue. They can happen from nearly anywhere, which is helpful. So, and there's no handshake rules required there. So I appreciate the YouTube links there being dropped in. That's awesome. Final comments.
Oh, hey, it's Troy. Sorry, I was in a loud place. thanks, Richard, for the comments. Much appreciated. And about the question about the YouTube video, I did see Dimitri's videos this morning, but I can't post a link from my phone right now.
Okay. I think we've got a couple posted, and if you can, when you get there, make sure that they did get posted to this agenda, that would be really helpful.
Yeah, no problem.
One other interesting related non-Aries note. IBM announced a new engine for Fabric that sounds really interesting, called the Mir engine, Mir BFT. I'm excited. So it is open source now, but it's not integrated with Fabric. It boasts significantly higher performance with large node pools. So it'll be interesting to see how that impacts the ecosystem.
What was the name of that again, Richard?
Mir, like the space station, MIR BFT.
Ah, okay, thanks.
They say that they have 100 nodes in a pool and still have write throughput of thousands of transactions a second.
Other comments? Okay, I appreciate everyone going and representing the community. Sounds like it was well represented. Aries and Indy were well represented. Grateful that so many people got to present, which is pretty awesome. And to help the work move forward, that's really great. Okay, we have a trifecta of topics today that all relate to getting the DID exchange protocol moving forward at the rate that we would like instead of slowly. There's three things that we're going to talk about. One of them is the out of band protocol, and that is taking the place of the step zero, the invitation piece. Andrew has prepared a couple slides to guide the discussion around how to do signed attachments, which also relates. And then I have a PR that I want to discuss around the adding a continue and ACK type features to DID Exchange. And so we'll hit them in that order. Is there anything that we have to talk about that isn't on the list? Okay, we're going to proceed in that order, and we'll make it as far as we get. I've tried to put them in roughly an order of importance. And then we can go through them and ideally we solve all the problems today and make all the decisions and everybody's happy. So that's the plan. Let me stop sharing, Stephen, and give you the con so you can give us an update on out of band.
All right. Hang on one sec. There's what I want to share. Okay. Can you see my screen? Good.
Yep.
Might as well make it bigger. Okay. So it's going to be, it's still a PR, still discussion going on with it. It's a very, very long GitHub page. Takes a while to load. 434 out of band. This summarizes the original RFC. The link is there. Oh, I haven't posted the in chat the link, but I'll post this presentation. There's not much to it. The original RFC had an out-of-band protocol, singular, containing two messages, an invitation and a request. The invitation replaces the invitation from DataExchange, and the request replaces the ephemeral challenge, as we call it, which was basically has been used as a request presentation plus a service decorator, to which the receiver of the message can respond. These are combined into the RFC largely because they are out of band. They cannot be sent DIDCOM because there is no connection or no known connection between the two parties. So they are transferred in some method other than DIDCOM. QR codes is the standard example, but there is an example in there of using email for that. But the common factor is not DIDCOM. In any instance of the protocol, there is only one message type used. So you either use an invitation or you use a request. And the response, there is no response within the protocol. The responses always come from some other protocol that the out-of-band protocol asks the user to use. So there's options within the out-of-band message that the user, that the receiver of the out-of-band message can use to respond. So that was how we started. Next was, and this is what I really wanted to talk about, is here's the set of changes that have occurred since we talked about it a couple of weeks ago and where we got to. So basically cleanup and tweaks to the text and the JSON items. There's a few name changes and things like in the URL, the name of the query parameters changed. We added two fields to both messages, the goal code and the goal as strings to the message to allow the conveyance of a self-asserted purpose for the out-of-band message. So this is to give context to either a human or a machine to decide, do I want to respond to this question, to this request? Both of those fields should have localization applied. So they should use the localization decorator, but they aren't the same string, and that's why there's two fields. The code one is generally the protocol level, things like issue, verified credential. So the idea of once a connection is established, if it's an invitation, what is the next thing that's going to happen? Is it issue a credential? Is it going to be a request for a presentation? Or is it some other protocol that's going to happen? So the goal code is supposed to just provide a you know, sort of protocol level what's next. Well, the goal is to provide context that is more human consumable, that is something like, oh, Faber College wants to offer you a graduation credential. So it would be in the context of why you would want to issue a credential. The thought being there, if a human knows, oh, it's to issue a credential, their next question would be, what's a credential? So that's the thought. So both could be, as I say, localized. There was several discussions, including when we started and then during this back and forth on the PR, of having a field that is a list of protocols that would be executed after the connection was established. And we've multiple times now agreed that we don't want to do that, that it complicates it. And the compromise was the goal and goal code strings that allows that information to be conveyed without having to nail down, oh, these are the protocols that are going to follow. There are other ways for the sender to know at the completion of the connection process what they want to trigger next. So that was one significant change. The other was completed yesterday, which is breaking them into two protocols. So it's going to be one RFC with two protocols. So instead of it being an out-of-band protocol, it is an out-of-band invitation and an out-of-band request protocol specified within one RFC. The ramifications of that are that an agent could choose to support one or the other or both of the protocols, and that when responding to a discover features, not that it's an important one to discover, but they would say that they support one, the other, or both. So it is two protocols, and that also plays into the string, the type string of the messages. Basic reason there is only one of the messages is ever sent per instance of the protocols, and there is never a response on the protocol. So there's not any sort of within protocol back and forth. The response is always some other protocol. Today we added one more, which was something Kyle came up with, which was adding error handling of a received out-of-band message and how the response would go. So basically, if a receiver gets an out-of-band messages that say, I use Did Exchange version 2, and the receiver doesn't support that, they could send a problem report back of Did Exchange saying, I don't support that protocol, can we try a different version or whatever. So it allows the a problem report to be sent back. And then depending on how they do it, the responder or the initiator, the person that sent out the out-of-band message, can actually respond with DIDCOM. So if the problem report comes back with a service decorator on it, they could actually send another out-of-band messages, but this time with DIDCOM, which is kind of interesting. But anyway, so that becomes possible. And so there's some text in there about the handling of messages like that. And then finally, I missed this and kind of thought about it, but then didn't follow up and look, and Daniel did. Out-of-band became out-of-band throughout. So that change was the last one that was made. I think we're ready to go. I think we're very close. So I definitely am. And next up is really getting the next part of the discussion, which is what Sam and Andrew are going to talk about, which is updating Did Exchange, including, based on the impact of out-of-band, removing the invitation for the RFC and referencing the out-of-band RFC. So that's what I think that's all I've got to say. So that's that section. Any questions?
So, Stephen, what two protocols as opposed to one protocol with different roles? What's the advantage or disadvantage?
So the roles are the same. So the rationale is this. So there's two roles in both of them. They're the same two roles in both. The only tie between the two is that the messages are sent out of band. They don't. They would never be sent in the same instance of the protocol. So the feeling was, and it was, you know, not strong on either side, but generally felt to be a better idea of just let's have them as two protocols that are essentially independent of one another, but we'll have them in the same RFC because they are conveyed the same way. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yep. Yep.
The roles are still talked about throughout, and they are the same for both of them, and the flow is the same for both. So the state machine is the same for both.
Okay.
A quick question here. What is the authentication mechanism for this out-of-band messages? How does the recipient know that it's coming from a trusted issuer?
They don't. The idea is that they would have had to receive it in some out-of-band way. So it's not going to randomly come in and then they don't, and the agent would automatically process it. The controller behind the agent would have to decide and that could be a machine or it could be a human, they would have to decide whether they want to process, and they would have to take some active step to have the thing processed. So if it's a QR code, they've got to turn on their scanner and scan it. If it's an email, they would have had to have, you know, gone through the context and clicked on it such that it opened it up in the agent or something else. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but at least some rate limiting or something has to be in place. Otherwise, you could DDoS the system by sending those messages.
Absolutely. And that's up to the, well, that's up to the controller to decide how to handle it. Yes. I mean, you can't limit how often people send replies to it or anything like that. The controller would have to decide how to prevent it. There is a discussion about spam in that, in the PR discussion.
There is in this, the spam, the common use case that we're at least targeting it right now is that you need to provide the user a way to take something. For example, they're in a logged in session on a website, they get offered something and it shows up in a QR code with the out of band message, and then the user would scan it, and then the other side can then use the context of the presented QR with the fact that it was scanned and sent back from an agent in order to continue the context and then the operation that you're doing. So a denial of service attack doesn't make sense there, because all you do is like show 99 QR codes on the screen, and it's not really going to harm anything from an agent perspective. It's a really poor user experience. But and so there's not really a denial of service problem in the receiving of these messages when we're targeting those common cases of users. There is some discussion about whether these are appropriate in other contexts, and whether automated processing could be denial of service. But the common case that we're targeting, at least initially, that's not really a massive concern. The same thing with email. You can email someone 5,000 emails with a link in it, but that doesn't necessarily turn into actually ingesting those messages in the same manner. So the normal types of like DDoS protection stuff don't quite apply, because they're going through, at least in these common cases we're talking about now, they're going through a human element that's just going to say, this is stupid, and delete all 5,000 emails. Does that make sense? It's a little bit counterintuitive, I think, because of the difference in what the types of protocols we're normally dealing with.
Was goal added to both messages?
Yes. Okay. Goal and goal code are in both messages and optional. Label was also tagged as being optional in both messages. So you now have a label. One of the other benefits of goal is there would, I think, would be a temptation to overload label with not only the who it was from, but why it was sent. And if you use label as the default or initial name for the connection that you're establishing, having the reason why the connection was established is not good. So this will help make that a separation. So that was another reason for taking goal and goal code. Been great discussion on the whole PR. It's worked out well.
Awesome. Thank you, Stephen, for your work corralling the work there. Andrew, are you ready to talk about signed attachments?
Yep. I'll share my screen here. Here we go. So this mainly relates to the DID exchange protocol, which is meant be in the accepted state, but it's more of a proposal at the moment. And I think it affects it in two ways. One is when you send a connection response, we want a signature there to prove that you are the same party that controlled the invitation key, under the assumption that you're using a new key now in the DID document that you're sending. So yeah, it's only in one place. So you signed that DID doc with the original key to prove that you are the intended recipient. Although I'm sure we'll have other uses. So this is a general replacement for the signature attachments, which I think Kyle worked on. And there was a PR that Daniel Hartman put together and then closed because they decided that only entire messages needed to be signed. But I think we're pretty sure now that we need both. You may want to sign the whole message or you may want to sign parts of it. You might want to relay signed attachments from other parties. So this slide is just an overview of the two ways, well, two of the ways that you can use attachments or the attachment decorator at the moment. I don't have a cursor here. There we go. So you have a fairly open set of properties at the top level. You can describe the MIME type of your attachment, the file name, and then you have the data block. So the first example here has the attachment itself as inline base64 data. And the second attachment is a link to an external attachment along with a hash of that data. So you can verify it once it's downloaded. So not changing any of that. In Daniel Hartman's PR, he was, I think, taking out the base64 part of the inline attachment and replacing that with a signature block. So the signature block would be wrapping the content now, and you would have to pull that apart to get the content out, and you can check the signature while you're doing that. This is just a quick overview of JWS, the JSON Web Signatures standard. There's two formats for a JWS, well, there's three actually, formats for a JWS signature. The normal one up top here, which can support multiple signatures. And then if you only have one signature, you can flatten it into the bottom structure. And if you go right down to the end of the specification in Appendix F, I think, it mentions that you can actually leave out the payload here when the recipient knows how to get it, or you know, when it's in a property within the same object, which it is in our case. So that allows us to use the detached content mode of the JWS in all cases, really. It allows us to support external attachments, and it allows us to support inline attachments without wrapping the content. So it can be purely additive. And here's an example of that with an embedded attachment. So we still have the base64 here, but now we have a JWS block with the payload left out. One advantage of that is that the format of the content is independent, whereas JWS says it must be base64 URL formatted. You could support any format here as long as the recipient knows how to turn that into a string of bytes. We can't really support the compact format of the JWS, which is when you convert it into just a string instead of a JSON object, because that doesn't support unprotected headers. And I think in all cases here, we're going to have headers describing the party that created the signature. In this case, I'm using a KID. I'm not sure if we want to support KID and JWK or just one or the other. I'll get into that in a second. Here's an example of external data. So we still have the hash up here for parties that just want to verify that. Then we have links, and then we have the DWS as an optional additional verification. So for the protected headers on the JWS, we've got two fields here. ALG EDDSA just says that you're using an elliptic curve key. The recipient is going to figure out which key that is via the unprotected headers, either the JWK or the KID examples below. You can see the JWK version of a key is a lot more verbose. I would rather use this did key format, because you can use the same format there if you're a public issuer and you just want to reference a key that's in your did doc. And here in the protected headers, I've added the issued at time, which is, well, the name I borrowed from JWT, where it's used in the payload. But it's just a timestamp of when this signature was created that also functions as a nonce, so that you're not exposing your private key to additional risk by creating these signatures. And there's some references
Just an FYI for people, because I hear this a lot. A lot of people think you're exposing your keys by doing signatures, and then there's the risk.
Yeah, I might be wrong there.
Encryption. Signatures don't really leak that much versus encryption. So signatures, you could, like signing keys, you could sign tens of thousands of stuff for 10 years and it still wouldn't make it that much easier to brute force your key. Whereas encryption leaks a little bit each time. So that's why you rotate those often. So just wanted to clear that up a little bit. So
good to know.
So if you're doing JWS, you don't have to worry about, oh shoot, is my key getting leaked that way? So like ED2519 will not leak your signature key, your signing key.
Good. So this was borrowed from the signature attachment RFC.
Sure.
There was also a comment there that they weren't using JWS because that didn't support certain kinds of multi-party signatures, like the BLS signatures. But in the way that we're doing this, where the JWS is additive, and the payload is still accessible, you could have multiple kinds of signatures. The JWS is just one format. We could support additional formats later. And I think that's it. Do we have any other comments?
I have a couple. You mentioned that there's a flat versus the multi-signature capable.
Yes.
We know that having multiple signatures on an attachment is a super useful thing. So the question I have, and this may be a moot point, I've been arguing with myself about whether to ask it. If we're using a JWS, we're probably using a library for this, right? The question is it worth it for simplicity to always follow the top form that you're showing here, even if there's only one, or to just for the sake of simplicity, or if we should allow the flattened single signature form in the case that there's only single signature? That was the question I had. And maybe it doesn't matter because we're presumably not doing this by hand. We're using a library for it anyway. Any thoughts?
I think this may be used in some fairly space-constrained circumstances. It could be used in an out-of-bound invitation to add protections around an external attachment. An out-of-bound request, that is. And so in that case, using the flattened form is nice just because you're saving some bytes.
Actually, that argument sort of implies that we should allow the compact form as well of a JWS, meaning it gets piled up like a JWT, but missing the middle section for the external payload, because that's even a more terse form.
You can't include the KID in that case, though, unless you make it part of the protected headers, but that doesn't really make sense.
Oh, you're right.
There are no unprotected headers in that format.
That's totally true. So it's got to be one of these two. Anyway, so terseness is a good argument there for allowing for both. The other comment I had. Go ahead.
It's actually very easy to generate the JWS format. You don't really need a library for it.
That's true. If we allow the both forms, that means you're kind of checking which one is which, right? Is it signatures plural and everything's there, or is it signature singular and then you go looking in the same data structure for the header and the protected, right? Is really the functional difference. And that's not super complicated.
At the protocol level as well, there's like, what do you do if there are multiple signatures?
Right. So the other question I had was that you had put the JWS inside of the data element in the signature or in the attachment. And the only other thought I had was whether the JWS belongs as a sibling to data rather than inside of data.
Yeah, that might make sense to move it up to the top level.
That's not critical.
I think in the original specification, it was under the data blob because it contained the payload.
Oh, but if we're doing the external payload like you've designed, which I really like, by the way, then it might not need to be inside the data because it's not containing the payload.
Yeah, it can move up.
The other question I had, this is, I just don't know. In the case of an external thing, are you going to sign the hash or are you going to sign the entire external resource?
You're taking the entire content and passing it into the JWS signature generator.
So the hash in some ways is a little bit redundant in that case.
Yes.
Okay.
And you probably wouldn't do both, but you know, potentially it's nice to support.
Right, if you had hash both, but not signed. Right.
Yeah.
That's all I've got. That's all the questions I have.
And if Kyle had any comments, he did the original signature decorator there.
No, this looks pretty good.
I think Kyle's very happy to have not done this.
Yeah, I took a stab at it, and it just felt like a large portion of work, and then I realized that I was going in a direction that it probably didn't need to, and so starting over was probably the better approach for it.
Cool. So next steps, we need to, because what you're proposing here, which I think is the right answer, is a way of formalizing signatures on attachments generally, so that the attachment RFC needs an update that details this, right? And then we can reflect that in the DID exchange RFC?
Yeah, so we'll start with Daniel Hartman's revisions on that and go from there. And we'll have to put some rules on what's an acceptable JWS as well. No algorithm, none, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Right. Which I think is perfectly appropriate there. Also indicating that we may want to at least initially constrain it so that only certain sort of unambiguous data types can be done this way, like a Base64 and not necessarily like a JSON representation, just because of the difficulties of canonicalizing things like JSON.
Yes, true. We'll have to clarify that in there. Just to point out, in this case, the signature is over the bytes of the message, not the Base64 encoding of it.
Oh, we'll want to make that obvious too.
Yeah.
Right. the nice part about Base64 and bytes is you can move from one to the other. The case of like JSON, you can't really canonically move from one to the other. JSON to the bytes, I mean. So if you encode JSON as Base64, that's an interesting question too. Can you sign JSON as long as it's Base64? In that case, you'd actually want to sign the Base64 instead of the underlying bytes.
Well, you'd encode it into a string, sign that, and then Base64 it.
Okay. Yeah, nope, I could see that.
But yeah, I'd like to avoid the hairball of choosing a canonicalization method for JSON and just say that it has to be inlined as Base64.
Right. Cool. So is that an update to that attachments RFC that you're going to pursue?
Yes.
Awesome.
Yeah, we'll work on that this week.
Cool. And then when we get that merged in, we can make the associated changes to the examples and stuff and how we reference that inside of the Did Exchange RFC. Very cool. Thank you, Andrew. Any final comments, questions for Andrew? Sorry, I talked over you.
Just saying I'll add a link to the slides in the chat if anybody wants to.
Oh, awesome. If you wouldn't mind adding them to the wiki page too, that would be awesome. Okay, I am next in the trifecta of discussions around this. One of the oft-requested features of the DID Exchange protocol, that we discovered it during the Connections protocol, is that protocol left it was really squishy around the finalization message between the invitee and the inviter about how it was actually how that was done, and it basically said that any message could really be used there to confirm it, which is technically true, but practically really painful. There was the request to add a formal ACK that was part of the protocol and that was required to clean that up. And that way it could be a lot easier from an implementation perspective. And then later on, we had the goal of connection reuse, meaning if you found yourself engaged in a DID Exchange protocol or being presented with an invitation to one, and you already had a connection with the target that you'd like to reuse, a way to actually do that in a way that maintains the context of the out of band invitation and the resulting channel that you've got. The idea here is the out of band protocol can be referenced as the idea of that message can be referenced as a parent thread, which carries some context for the inviter, so that when the connection is complete, they can then do something else like issue the credential that they were trying to do or something along those lines. And so that's a useful thing. I have a PR. That contains what I think is a thing that will accomplish both of these goals. Subject to our conversation, I will either modify this or we can seek to merge it as is. I've added a step three. Step zero, by the way, is going away, which is the invitation that's being moved into the out-of-band protocol. Step one is sending a request, and the request goes from the invitee to the inviter. And then the response goes from the inviter to the invitee. And all of the information has then been exchanged, but there's been no acknowledgement to the inviter that it's been completed and it's acceptable to everyone.
Actually, there was an ACK right at the end to do precisely that. So I'm guessing you substituted that out for this or something?
There actually wasn't an ACK. It was commonly used, but it was not in the RFC.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That's part of the reason why we're trying to motivate this to be more formal. In what it said, you can see in the stuff that I've removed here in the diff that there should be a message, but any message will do. Meaning it doesn't have to be an explicit ACK as part of that. And so that was one of the things that was causing issue with the previous one and why we needed to do it. And this suggested, for example, that a trust ping could be used. An ACK was commonly used, but wasn't in the RFC. So we have two goals. One is to explicitly acknowledge the completion in a message from the invitee to the inviter. And the second thing is to allow connection reuse. And so let's go through the ACK stage first. This complete message becomes a required part of the protocol as step three. And upon sending it and then receiving it on the other side, both the invitee and the inviter end up into the complete state. But this becomes more explicit because this is the message that is sent, which means that there's no, you know, there's no longer some squishy flow or the commons of sending a generic ACK message, but not necessarily including it directly. So this accomplishes that goal. The second goal is connection reuse. And there's two pieces of connection reuse. The first one that I'll touch on very lightly is how you decide to reuse a connection. And the consensus that we've come up with is that if the out-of-band invitation contains a public DID for you to begin the exchange, that's one of the forms of that, and you receive and you go ahead and establish a connection, you want to retain that public DID just as an attribute of the connection or something that you can index to, so that if you receive another one with the same public DID, you can identify that you already have a connection with that entity. Even if it results in the exchange of a peer DID, you still know that you started from the public DID in that, and so you have an existing connection. So the thought that I had was that the continue message, as we've been calling it, is so similar to an ACK, meaning this is done, we should continue, that I thought that using it another message for the same, or using the same message for the reuse purpose would be useful. And so what I've described here is that if you end up in a circumstance where you want to reuse the connection, instead of sending a request that then has a response coming back and then you end up with a new connection, you would simply jump immediately to the complete message using the existing connection. So I receive it from a DID that I already have a connection with. I receive the out-of-band invitation. I discover an existing one that I desire to reuse. It's an optional part, but I desire to reuse it. I would use that existing connection and send this complete message and referencing the parent thread ID of that out-of-band invitation message that I was acting on. Even though it's the same public DID as before, it quite likely has a different message ID because of the context in which it was given. Imagine, for example, that it's being presented by my bank in a logged-in web browser session. And so that ID would be associated with different context on the inviter side, and passing the parent thread ID would allow the invitee to connect the context present in the out-of-band invitation with the existing connection and then could act on it. The nice part here is that after an invitation is created, there will often be a desired follow-on interaction or follow-on protocol that you want to jump to. And that's the same if you create a new connection or if you're reusing an existing connection. And so combining those flows into the same message means that the outcome of the complete message is likely going to be the same in either case. You're going to use the connection that exists, either the one you just made or the one, or this is one that existed previously, and then you're going to take the next step based on the context that you can associate because of the parent thread ID being passed in this message. So that's the idea that I had on combining those. So questions: is this a good idea? Is it worth having two separate messages for the purpose? Or does combining it into the same one make sense? And does this fit the needs of both an explicit ACK, and does this work to continue and reuse an existing connection?
So Sam, I'm probably missing something here, but if you have an invitation with a public DID in it, and you store that in a connection, the invitee with that invitation, I can then look to see if I already have already accepted that invitation or already have another connection for some other reason with that public DID associated with it. So I, as the invitee, why do I need to tell the inviter that I'm going to use this connection for something else? Why would I not just, send the flow? Is it for the case where we need to tell the invitee that We're not going to create another connection, but now the invitee is going to start some other conversation with us over that existing connection?
That's exactly the case. And okay. Here's the common flow that we're going after, right? When you're presented a QR code, the medium step is creating a connection, but there's often a bigger step that you want as part of there. For example, let's say you just took a training class and you would like to receive a credential that says you completed the training class. From a user perspective, giving them a QR code to scan is really convenient. And so they're going to scan that QR code. And when the connection's complete, then the inviter is going to automatically, you know, begin the process of issuing you a credential. If you have an existing connection, though, it doesn't really know that.
I got you. It makes sense now.
Yep. And the piece of context that's really useful is the ID of the message in the out-of-band invitation becomes the parent thread ID here, which allows the inviter to say, oh, I know what that's for, and then act on it over the existing connection as well as any new connections.
So it's for those types of invitation that have a then component in them. Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. So that they know when they can start the then part of that invitation again. Yeah.
Correct. And which connection to use for the then.
Yes. Gotcha.
Yeah. And that's a flow that we've seen in our existing implementations, but only for new connections. And we didn't have a reasonably good way to reuse an existing connection, but still have the same flow benefit.
Yep. Okay.
Hey, Sam, I posted a question on the PR, but since we're on it, why isn't this PR removing the invitation message?
Because it's a separate process. Updating the DID exchange, I'm trying to keep this specific PR focused on this change.
Okay.
Not make all the changes simultaneously. There will be additional ones that remove the invitation message and update the signatures and those other things.
Oh, I see.
So Sam, this may have been totally clear to everyone else from the beginning, but a web sequence diagram showing that would be worth, you know, would make that clear if it was unclear to anyone else.
I think there's two sequence diagrams that could be used here. One is that it's probably time we had one for the DID exchange protocol itself.
Yeah.
And a second one that showed the variation for connection reuse would also be very useful.
Right. Yeah, that's what I meant here. Yep.
I'm making a note for that.
Sam, I had one issue with reusing the complete message here in that because you have both roles sending the same message, there is a chance, I think, with a buggy implementation that you end up in kind of an infinite loop where they keep replying to each other on these complete messages.
So quickly, both roles, both the invitee and the inviter send this message?
In different circumstances, it looks like.
No, that's not the intent.
No.
It's always from the invitee to the inviter.
Yeah.
But one happens... after a new request and response, and the other one just happens over the existing connection instead of the starting with the request.
Okay, maybe that's all right then.
Yeah, so it's used to confirm the exchange to the inviter from the invitee. I could make that more explicit in the language.
Right. Steven,
any comments here?
No, it looks good. looks good.
I imagine myself writing the handlers for this message while I was designing this. Exactly, and I like the fact that the handler can, it can conditionally mark a new connection as confirmed or complete, right? But it then also says, hey, based on the parent thread ID, what's next, and can invoke whatever next actions are required in both cases. So it sort of brings those flows together.
Yeah.
I guess it's just a minor issue, but the word complete kind of indicates that the connection is maybe over and done with.
So the thing I fought with, continue was one of the other things that we had talked about. And I thought about calling this the continue message. That felt weird in the case under you, in the case that you didn't have a follow-on protocol you wanted to jump into. I think is maybe more clear.
Yeah.
And that conveys the same meaning that I had intended without implying, as you pointed out, that it means it's done with. So I like established, and I'll change the message name to established.
Okay, it works for me.
Other comments? Okay, this is about to make it to the RFC, so if you don't like this, you don't want to write it. Now's the time to speak up.
I mean, I can see, if you really want to be clear, I mean, established would be for the first one. And I think I would slightly vote for a different name for the continue, you know, or for the reuse. I'd just say established and reuse.
And have be two separate messages with the same form.
Yes. Of course, I guess the established one would not have the parent thread one, or wouldn't, you know, have to.
It wouldn't have to. Yeah.
But
from an implementation standpoint, I kind of prefer the one message, because then your logic's only in one place per what do I do now that I have a connection.
Established doesn't necessarily mean that you just established one. It's that, you know, this is an established connection. But maybe I'm tilting it at the wind here. The reuse would make that case much more explicit. But then you have two places where you're considering the follow-on outcome. Because the parent thread would actually be useful in both cases, now that I think about it, because that way you can grab that parent thread ID without having to necessarily maintain it in extra context.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just thinking it's pretty easy to have an alias for, if there actually turns out to be no cases where we always treat the logic the same, then it's just an alias for the same thing. It doesn't really complicate the logic from my perspective. Your handler is the same, but if there is some slight difference, then it makes that clear, and it certainly is clearer reading it, I think. But anyway, that's my.
I appreciate you expressing your opinion there. Other opinions about one message versus two message.
I guess the other option would be to have a property in the message that says whether you think you're resuming a connection or not. But I'm not suggesting we need that. Should I explain that further?
So it's clear to me. Anyone have questions about that idea? The idea is you have an extra property up here, right, in the message that indicates if this is, you know, like maybe a Boolean flag, whether this is a reuse connection or true. Could be optional in the case that it's false, of course. It might come down to a developer confusion issue, meaning even if, you know, you could also in your message handlers, you know, you could call a common function that actually does the next behavior in that particular case, which means that if we did make an explicit reuse, it could avoid some developer confusion. in that particular case. Come on, folks, who's got opinions? We've heard from like three of us. We need to hear from more of us. Have we put everybody to sleep? I'm starting to think that everyone's mute buttons are broken.
Yeah. I was thinking if I'm debugging something and I'm looking for messages, seeing a reuse message makes it clear from a debugging perspective what's happening, you know.
I like the reuse as well because it's explicit what's going on. It's not conflating two possible paths.
Okay. I've tried to give that like at least a half Nathan of my awkward silence timer. I think those are good arguments. I think that seeing them in a debug log and the potential for reducing developer confusion and implementation, I think is probably worth it. And so I will rework the PR to split those messages so that they are intentionally very different flows. That actually as well, I think, simplifies the flow diagram situation as well, where there's not an optional entry at this, you know, third message in the exchange. So I will go ahead and split that. Thank you for speaking up and sharing opinions. Any final comments on this?
Do we need to define an error code when you received a continue, but you no longer have that connection, Andy?
Probably. Like, it's like
connection not found.
This reminds me of like an ex, like girlfriend situation, right? Like you text somebody that should know your number, and they're like, "Sorry, who is this?"
I guess yes. You wouldn't, because they wouldn't be able to unpack it anyway. Maybe they would unpack it, but they've lost the connection state.
You would assume that if they can decrypt the message that they know who you are, right? That's one of the benefits of authenticated encryption. So in that case, like it just falls and nothing happens. Which would be interesting.
They just get an unrecognized message problem report.
No, because you can't decrypt the message.
Well, you don't really know where to send it.
Yeah. It's a direct response. You've got is a, all you've got is a header.
Can I call that the talk to the hand use case?
Thud.
So, yeah. Okay. So I'm going to rewrite this to explicitly call them out. Given that we have, do we like reuse or continue better?
I like continue because it's used in HTTP.
I think reuse is a little bit more obvious that this is an old connection that you're exercising again.
Yeah, I think the context of HTTP continue is a different connotation too. So
When we're splitting these, I think the comment about complete being final or done might be still super valid. Established, or do we want to go back to just using ACK for that particular message? Established feels a little bit more formal and clear. Again, I'm thinking about the developer reading the logs of messages.
If it's ACK, then I guess there'd be questions about whether you only do it when there's a please ACK.
Yeah. I'd rather established.
No, ACK is not only done when the receiver receives the please ACK operator. ACK can also be a formal message in a protocol, an adopted message, basically.
Right. We could adopt the message. And that would be a little bit more generalizable. Having established would be useful, although established is weird because you don't establish a DID exchange. You complete a DID exchange.
Yeah.
And so from the complete perspective, having the DID exchange be, this isn't the connections protocol anymore. This is a DID exchange protocol. And so completing a DID exchange protocol actually might be the right word there if we're going to use that instead of ACK. So now that we talked that through, established feels weird to me just because of the naming of how the protocol works.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to leave that as good. So we have complete versus ACK. Thinking of the same, the developer reading the message logs, I think complete is really explicit about what's going on. Do we have any arguments in favor of using ACK as an adopted message? Okay, I'm going to leave that as complete, and I'm going to split the messages into complete and reuse. And I will update the PR with that and signal it out for any further discussion on that PR before we merge that, so that any new issues or mistakes that I've made can be corrected before that gets merged. Other comments on the ACK complete phase of DID exchange?
I think in the state, well, there isn't a state diagram, but in the states of the protocol right now, the final state is called active. Maybe we should just rename that to complete for consistency.
I should definitely fix that so that it is, so that that's consistent. I will make a note. Thank you, Andrew. Awesome. Okay, and that brings us to the end of our agenda for the day. In the final minute or two, is there any topics that anyone is dying to have happen next week? Man, tough crowd.
There was a thought from Nathan, and I don't know whether we should do this yet, but start to think about what Aries 1.0 is. We talked a little bit about that at Hyperledger last week forum. Try to remove this thing of people going to Indy because it's 1.0, whereas Aries isn't, even though Aries builds on top of Indy, and you don't really want to touch Indy without building on top of it.
Yeah, so to add a little bit to this idea, for business reasons, political reasons, it's really important that we have something that is viewed as a stable community release. And we would like that to be, whether it's Aries 1.0 to match the Aries interop profile release, or whether we want to call it a 2.0 in order to indicate that it's the successor to Indy's SDK 1.0, we need to put together something that we call a stable release, and we ought to see what we can do to coordinate between the frameworks to have a release that meets whatever standards we have a consensus on. And I think the Aries interop profile is a reasonable way of kind of trying to coordinate between the different frameworks. But just saying that there is an interop profile won't be enough to show the community that we are to a open for business point in our coding.
Super good topic. I will put that on the agenda for next week and try to organize some conversations about that. We are at the end of our time. I appreciate everyone. Oh, go ahead.
Sam, one quick question. Is this the right forum to discuss DidAuth? Is that something that we can discuss?
We can. There is a working group at the DIF talking about DidAuth. And so I don't know. I think that discussing it as it relates to the Aries project is useful. I think trying to figure out what DidAuth is or what the requirements are may not be the right scope for this. But if we are trying to integrate DidAuth into an Aries project, I think that's certainly relevant. Is that?
Yeah, because from a wallet perspective or agent's perspective, it has to understand DidAuth.
Depends what you mean by DidAuth, which is one of the confusions I have around DidAuth and what they include there.
Well, I'm just reviewing the specification, so I'm again very new to this. You guys might have a better understanding of it.
Well, I should read it again.
Very similar to WebAuth, the same as FIDO, where you have a request challenge protocol.
It sounds like their definition of web, of DidAuth has actually constrained back down to something normal. It was a little bit wide and varied when it first showed up. And so I should go read that again and see how it applies. I'll add that to my list of potential topics, though.
Cool. Thank you.
Thank you for the idea. We are out of time, folks. Thank you for coming, and we will see you on Rocket Chat and in PRs and Issues, and we will see you back here next week. Thanks so much for coming.